Hello everyone, and welcome back to Murder, Mother and Me, where each week we will dive into some of the most infamous murders, mysteries and everything in between.
So if like us you are intrigued by all things true crime, you're in the right place.
I'm your host Josh.
And I'm your other host Patty. I'm the mother.
And I'm the me.
As always, thank you for all the support so far on our podcast.
Please don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Murder, Mother and Me Podcast. Share with your friends and write us a review.
But only if it's a good one.
Right everyone, let's get on with this week's episode. This is the case of the Dyatlov Pass incident. In 1959, nine experienced hikers set out into the Ural Mountains and never made it home. What search teams found weeks later raised more questions than answers. A torn tent, impossible injuries, and a mystery that refuses to stay buried. Nine experienced hikers, one frozen mountain slope, a single night where everything went wrong. But before we go any further, let's go right back to the beginning. Before we talk about the hikers, before we talk about the tent, the footprints, or the theories, we have to talk about the place itself, because the Dyatlov Pass incident does not begin with the people, it begins with the land. The northern Ural Mountains stretch across Russia in long, weather-worn ridges, shaped by not height or drama, but by time and erosion. These are not mountains that intimidate at first glance. Their slopes are rounded, their peaks modest, and that appearance can be dangerously misleading. To experienced hikers, especially those trained in winter travel, the terrain can seem manageable, even forgiving. But in the winter, the Urals reveal their true nature. Temperatures regularly drop below minus 30 degrees Celsius, and when the wind rises, which it often does, the cold becomes aggressive, stripping heat from the body faster than the mind can fully register what's happening. Exposed skin freezes quickly, breathing turns painful, muscles stiffen. Tasks that normally require little thought, tying a knot, lighting a stove, adjusting equipment, suddenly demand focus and calm, two things extreme cold erodes with terrifying efficiency. The wind is especially unforgiving here. It doesn't move gently across the landscape, it funnels downhill, gaining speed as it crosses open slopes. Sudden gusts can knock a person off balance or collapse a tent without warning. Sound behaves strangely in these conditions, carried and distorted by the wind so that direction becomes difficult to judge. What feels distant can feel immediate. What feels threatening may be nothing at all. Visibility too becomes an enemy. Snowstorms can form rapidly, turning a clear horizon into a featureless white space in minutes. On exposed slopes where trees and landmarks disappear, even experienced navigators can lose their sense of direction. Depth perception collapses, the ground, the sky, and the air blend into one. And once disorientation sets in, panic doesn't need much encouragement. What do you think about that then? Sounds like a pretty eerie place.
Sounds like our garden last week when the wind was really high and trees were blowing everywhere.
Well, you certainly wouldn't want to be stuck outside in a tent in those kind of conditions, would you?
No, it makes me wonder why anyone goes there, to be honest.
When I've been skiing, sometimes, you know, because you're so high up, sometimes you're 3,000-4,000 foot above sea level. We call it pea soup, so it's like you literally can't see your hands in front of your face. It's that misty and foggy.
It used to be like that in Liverpool in the 60s, you know. No, seriously, it did. It did. You used to go into town, especially, and the fog was rolling off from the pierhead, you know, across the Mersey, and it was just really thick. I remember it when I was about 5, 6, 7, that kind of age.
Well, I couldn't even imagine being stuck at the top of a mountain in a tent and you can't even see your hands in front of your face. Like, imagine how scary that must be.
Why do you go there then?
I don't know. People just have weird attraction to, like, thrills, don't they?
It's like all these dead bodies that are left on Everest or all these big mountains and they can't retrieve them because they're so high up. What a way to go. Why would you want to go there and just die there and just stay there?
So? Well, I'm assuming they don't go there to die, Mum.
No, but it's a possibility. A yeah, it's a risk. Yeah, so they go and do it and then... Well, I just think that's horrible, don't you? I don't know why anyone would put themselves in any danger. Like when they go into those cave-in things as well and go underground. Now, come on. That's just...
Forget that.
You know, there's been some horrible things.
You couldn't even pay me. The mountain the hikers would attempt to cross was known to the local Mansi people as Kolatsiakul, often translated as Dead Mountain. The name wasn't born from superstition or legend, it was practical. The Mansi avoided the area because there was nothing there. No shelter, no animals, no reason to stay. Storms swept across the slope unchecked and survival depended entirely on preparation and judgement. In the winter of 1959, 9 hikers stepped onto the mountain believing they had both. They could not have known that this landscape, quiet, open, and seemingly manageable, would soon strip them of certainty, shelter, and time itself. When stories like this are retold over decades, the people at the center of them often become symbols rather than individuals. Hikers, explorers, victims. But before the Dyatlov Pass into them was a mystery, it was a group of 9 very real people with distinct personalities, skills, and reasons for being there. This was not a random collection of adventurers. All 9 were students or graduates of the Ural Polytechnic Institute, studying fields like engineering, physics, and radio technology, disciplines that prized logic, preparation, and problem solving. Winter hiking in the Soviet Union was not a casual hobby. It was structured, regulated, and deeply tied to national pride. To earn a Grade 3 hiking certification, the highest level available, participants had to prove not only physical endurance, but the ability to make calm, rational decisions under extreme stress.
So that explains why they were there. So it was part of their university education, wasn't it? To help them gain, you know, as you say, problem-solving skills, etc. What a place to send them to, though. It's not Colomendy, is it?
No, it's definitely not Colomendy. And that's like a school trip in the UK that you get sent on when you're a kid, for anyone that doesn't know.
It's like basically you sleep in barracks.
Yeah. And you have to do all kinds of things like orienteering, raft building, like survival skills, actually, to be fair.
I'm surprised that someone never phoned Childline, actually, when they were there, because it was pretty grim, wasn't it, really?
It was very grim. But yeah, so they're earning this Grade 3 hiking certification. And to be fair, it does say that it's the highest level that they can achieve. And to get it, you do have to be good at problem solving and preparing and stuff like that. So these were people that were not, you know, uneducated on hiking.
No, they knew what they were going into, didn't they? And it was a real challenge, wasn't it? And that was the whole point of it, really.
Their leader, Igor Dyatlov, was just 23 years old, but already widely respected. He was methodical and detail-orientated, known for planning routes with precision and designing his own equipment when standard gear wasn't good enough. Friends later said that Igor believed most disasters were preventable if you thought far ahead enough. Zinaida Kolmogorova was known for her optimism and emotional resilience. Her diary entries often framed hardship as something to be endured and even embraced. Lyudmila Dubinina, outspoken and stubborn, had been seriously injured on a previous expedition and still refused to turn back from difficult routes. Rustem Slobodin was disciplined and athletic, while Yuri Doroshenko was physically powerful and confident in extreme conditions. I don't want to laugh because they're actually real people, but I found that so difficult to get through those names. Like, okay.
It was difficult for me and I was just listening.
Oh my God, there's one more.
Go on, go for it.
Then there was Semyon Zolotaryov, the oldest of the group at 38. A decorated World War II veteran, he had survived combat, explosions and chaos. Experiences that shaped him into someone not easily rattled. His presence added an additional layer of experience to an already very capable team.
So these all sound like people that are all very capable, that don't panic under pressure or extreme conditions, which makes what happens to them even more mysterious.
The remaining members, Yuri Krivonishenko, Alexander Kolevatov, and Nikolai Thibault-Brignol, rounded out the group with technical knowledge, quiet intelligence, and a sense of humour that helped keep morale high during long days in the cold. Because whatever happened on that mountain did not happen to inexperienced hikers making reckless decisions. It happened to people who understood cold, risk, and survival. People trained to assess danger and respond methodically, which makes the choices they would later make all the more disturbing. They trusted their planning, they trusted their skills, and most of all, they trusted each other. And that trust would be tested and ultimately broken in a place where mistakes were never forgiven.
They sound like a really well-balanced group as well, don't they? All different personalities, all bringing something different to the table, so all able to support each other.
It sounds like, you know, when you watch a film and like it's a bank robbery or something and they've always got like the brains, the brawn.
That's what I mean.
Like the tech guy.
Yeah.
Someone that can like crack a safe. It sounds like that, like they've all got different expertise.
Oh God, that's like when we went to that escape room.
Oh yeah, and we didn't escape.
Money heist, and we ran out of time.
We would be useless.
Had to do the walk of shame outside.
The journey began on January 23rd, 1959, in a way that felt ordinary, almost routine. The group travelled by train first, then by truck, gradually leaving behind towns, roads, and any real connection to the outside world. They moved deeper into the wilderness. The infrastructure faded away, replaced by snow-covered paths and improvised routes. Photographs taken during these early days showed relaxed faces and playful moments. The hikers joke for the camera, pose with skis, and document their progress with the kind of casual confidence that comes from experience. Their diaries reflect fatigue and cold, but nothing unusual. No fear, anxiety, or sense of foreboding. This matters because it tells us something important. Whatever happened later was not building slowly over days. It did not announce itself early. On January 28th, the group's dynamic changed for the first time. Yuri Udin, struggling with worsening joint pain and illness, made the difficult decision to turn back. It was a practical choice, made calmly and without drama. He hugged the others goodbye and watched them continue forward, skis disappearing into the trees. Years later, Udin would describe replaying the moment endlessly, wondering if he missed something. A subtle tension, a change in mood, a sign that something was wrong. But he always came back to the same conclusion. Everything felt normal. The remaining nine continued north, deeper into isolation, unaware that they were now completely alone. This actually does sound like the synopsis of a film. Like, it doesn't sound like it's even real so far.
No, I know. He was lucky, wasn't he, turning back?
Sometimes you get that gut feeling, don't you? That, I know it's saying he had joint pain
injured,
and stuff.
Wasn't he, or
yeah, and he was obviously injured, but I think, I don't know, for people that are experienced, I'm not sure that would be enough for you to turn around and go back.
No, I think it was a calculated decision. I think he was probably thinking he was going to hold the others back. And so, as a team effort, it was the right thing to do, wasn't it? But, so I didn't think it was for any other reason.
Well, as it happened, it was probably the smartest decision he ever made.
The way you just read that then, though, it was almost like saying he was looking for some subtle signs that there was something wrong within the camp, but there wasn't, was there? It was something unpredictable that happened.
Yeah, I think that's the main thing. It says that spirits were high, they were laughing and joking on camera. He's obviously had to turn around because of an injury, and later on when this horrific thing's happened, he's looked back and thought, was there something going on in that camp? But from his recollection, there was absolutely nothing wrong. Everyone was happy and fine.
Yeah, and I don't think that, you know, with what happened, I don't think that it would be anything like that anyway. But I suppose you do think things like that when looking back with hindsight.
Well, he's probably got horrendous survivor's guilt as well, hasn't he? Thinking that he probably should have been there with them. By January 31st, 1959, the hikers had reached the edge of the forest, the point where the dense trees gave way to exposed slope of Kolatsiakl. The night ahead would be the last, and the decisions made in those hours would define the tragedy that followed. Here, the group faced a choice that has puzzled investigators for decades. Where should they camp? They could have stayed within the protective cover of the forest, shielded from the wind and snow. That would have been the safer, more conventional choice, but they didn't. Instead, they pitched their tent on the open slope of the mountain. At first glance, it seems reckless. To modern eyes, it is hard to imagine why anyone would deliberately expose themselves to the full force of a winter storm on an unshielded mountainside. Yet in the context of the expedition and Soviet hiking culture, the decision was logical. They were experienced hikers trained for winter conditions, accustomed to navigating exposed slopes. Camping higher meant maintaining their planned route, saving time, and meeting the requirements of their Grade 3 certification, the highest winter hiking certification of the time. It was, in their mind, a calculated risk.
I'd have gone for the trees.
I mean, I would have gone for the trees all day, but I know absolutely nothing about hiking.
I think it's probably because they were trying to fulfil a set of criteria to get them the credits that they needed. So that's like a box ticked, isn't it? Camping on an open slope, you know what I mean? And it was saving them time. It was, I don't know how close the trees were. They said close, but maybe it was another, it would have taken them another couple of hours or something. Because close doesn't mean it's like, you know, 5 minutes away.
No, it could be a
away.
Couple of miles.
Yeah, so maybe, you know, they wanted to stick to plan, didn't they? And that's why they did it. I still think that's quite a big risk to take.
Well, like we just said, it was a calculated risk from their part, wasn't it? And I think between the nine of them, as we've just discussed before, they all had different levels of expertise in different areas. So I assume nine people putting all their minds together, it's a calculated risk that they were all willing to take and thought was a good idea.
Yeah, but after saying that, though, it's still a tent, just a cloth tent on an open slope of a mountain with winds howling around you. So to me, that would be a no, but I'm not a hiker, so I don't know.
They pitched the tent and they organised their supplies. They ate, drank tea and prepared for a night that seemed by all counts routine. Photographs show smiles, camaraderie and what appears to be ordinary expedition life. Nothing in their behaviour suggested fear, confusion, or urgency. But something changed that night. Something unseen, unheard, and terrifying. At some point after dark, the group made a unanimous decision. They had to leave the tent immediately. There was no debate, no hesitation, no recorded arguments. Not even a note in their diaries mentioning the change in plans. Whatever it was, it struck all 9 hikers at once, convincing them that staying inside the tent was far more dangerous than stepping into the freezing darkness outside. And yet the circumstances of their departure were extraordinary. They abandoned warmth, shelter, boots, jackets and supplies. Some left in socks, others without proper clothing. Cameras, money and personal belongings were left behind. Items that anyone else would have considered essential for survival. But why? Investigators can only speculate. Perhaps the wind had shifted in a way that made the tent unstable. Perhaps snow had accumulated on the roof, threatening collapse. Perhaps they had heard a sound, the creak of ice, a crack of fallen snow. That must have triggered panic. Or perhaps something else entirely. Something psychological, something primal, drove them to flee with urgency that overrode logic, training, and experience. It was a decision with fatal consequences. So you know what I don't understand about this now? So we've just spoke about how camping in a tent on a open slope is a calculated risk, and they wanted to, in no other words, tick the boxes of the grade 3 hiking certification. So they obviously wanted to stick to the plan as much as they possibly could, putting themselves at risk potentially to do that. So why now in the middle of the night? Is it not a calculated risk to run out of your tent in socks in the freezing cold and just abandon camp? Where's the calculated risks?
Well, I think
now?
Obviously it's been something that's terrified them. And when something is, you know, terrifies you like that, all logic goes out the window. It's fight or flight, isn't
Completely.
It? So, and in this case, it was flight. And the interesting thing about it is, I think it doesn't mention it there, but the way they left the tent, they didn't leave through the front. They didn't leave through the entrance. They cut a hole through the back of the tent. So they cut a big flap out of the back to go out that way. And that is just a mystery. Why on earth would you take the time to do that? What was to be gained by that? And then they actually all ran in different directions. Some stayed together and some ran. They were found in different places. So again, it wasn't, as you say, they were used to making decisions together. And so did they not have time to say, right, we're going to go this way and we're all just going to run to the forest or this way away from whatever it was? They all just seemed to scatter by the sounds of what happened.
And we're talking, when I was describing this place, these mountains at the beginning, it said it can reach minus 30 degrees Celsius, which is, well, obviously 30 degrees below freezing. This is not somewhere that you would be able to survive very long in a pair of socks. Let's put it that way.
So I think you can take from that there was something absolutely did terrify them and they just went for it. But why would they cut a hole in the back of
the
tent?
Well, like we said, you're talking about experienced hikers here that would know the consequences of running out of that tent with no gear, with no shoes on. So something has had to scare them enough that all of that logic went out the window completely, entirely. It's gone. We're just running for our
question
lives.
Question is, what was it that scared them?
Even the terrain they faced was unforgiving. The slope was exposed, steep enough to require careful steps in deep snow. Wind whipped across the mountainside, carrying temperatures well below minus 30 degrees Celsius. Every step outside the tent stripped warmth from their bodies and every breath burned their lungs with ice. The snow was soft in some places, hard packed in others, unpredictable and exhausting. Yet they walked, step by step, footstep after footstep, they moved away from the only shelter they had known that night. Step by step, they entered into the unknown. The tent left behind becomes one of the most haunting symbols of the Dyatlov Pass incident. It shows the moment before fear overtook reason. It shows a structure, still upright, still containing everything necessary for survival, abandoned not because of negligence, but because the hikers perceived a threat far greater than the cold, a threat that remains a mystery to this day. It is in this moment, the choice to leave the tent, that the tragedy begins in earnest. Every decision after this point, every step into the darkness, every frantic movement towards trees, rocks, or the slope below flows from this single, horrifying choice. And yet, as we will see in the forest, on the slope, and in the ravine, their movements were not chaotic. They were deliberate. They were attempts at survival. rational efforts made in a context where rationality had been overtaken by fear, instinct, and the brutal demands of the mountain. When the search teams finally arrived at the campsite on February 26, 1959, they expected to find a typical winter disaster, a collapsed tent, perhaps some scattered belongings, evidence of a struggle. What they found instead was something far stranger. The tent itself, a bright orange canvas pitched on the exposed slope of Kolat Siachal, was partially collapsed under the weight of snow. That in itself was unsurprising. Snow accumulates quickly in the Urals. Yet, the investigators noticed something immediately unsettling. The tent had been cut open from the inside. Long, clean slashes ran through the canvas. They were too deliberate, too precise to be accidental. Experienced hikers trained in winter survival do not cut their way out of tents under normal circumstances. They use zippers, flaps, designed exits. The fact that these slashes existed suggested one of two things. Either the normal exits were blocked, crushed, or trapped by snow, or the hikers perceived them as unusable. Something so terrifying inside the tent that the only option seemed to be escape by force. Inside, everything was left behind. Boots neatly lined up, jackets folded and draped over the tent floor, food untouched in cans and bags. Money, cameras and personal belongings were all still there. Not a single item had been taken. Not a single item suggested preparation for a long walk in sub-zero temperatures. This was not a careful evacuation, not a planned retreat. It was a flight born of urgency, fear and confusion. Investigators noted the footprints leading away from the tent. They were strange. Some hikers were even barefoot. Some wore only socks. Some had one boot on, the other abandoned in the snow. And yet, the tracks were calm and methodical. There was no running, no scrambling, no chaotic tangles of movement. Step by step, the group walked downhill, toward the forest, toward the trees, and ultimately into what would become their deaths. See, now that is just so conflicting to what my head tells me must have happened, which is something's terrified them and they've darted out of that tent and they've all ran in different directions.
Yeah, I think initially probably they were going in the same direction, but I think they were found in different locations.
Yeah, but this suggests that they all walked downhill together. So why are some in bare feet, some in socks, and some got one boot on and one boot off? But they're all walking, no one's running.
But the fact that they cut open the tent tells you that they wanted to get out of that tent as soon as possible and probably didn't have time to grab anything. So it was sounds like it was in the middle of the night, so they were maybe half undressed and they've just done what's needed, but with a limited amount of time to get out. Something must have posed a really instantaneous direct threat to them.
But what doesn't make sense to me is, yeah, I agree with all that. Obviously, something's happened that scared them so much that they have to get out of that tent by any means. But that level of chaoticness of them not grabbing anything or anything like that.
But it's not, though, is it? Because it's quite methodical, really. It probably in a very short space of time that was allowed to them, they've decided, we're going to leave this tent, we're going to do it together, and we're going to go as we are. And they've slashed the back open, and out they've gone together.
But why are they then walking downhill all together? They're not running, they're walking. So if something was a direct threat to me, I'm not walking away from it. Unless it was something like a fire or something. You know what I mean? I'm still, like, well, if I'm panicking, I'm running.
But maybe they couldn't run because maybe the snow was too deep for them to run. And they were, it was more sensible to them, you know, for them to go slow to get to the destination rather than panic. I'm sure there was some level of panic, but it was controlled panic maybe then because they're so used to doing this kind of thing. So quick risk assessment. As you say, why would you not grab a coat? But it seems to be something that was bearing down on them pretty quickly. And yet they've retained the presence of mind to make it somewhat of a controlled exit.
And now, ironically, they're now heading back towards the forest where they considered camping in the first place.
But that was for different reasons, was it? Now this forest may offer protection that
from whatever is threatening
them.
But
what was it, though? So we'll go into this a bit more, I think.
Consider the environment they faced. The slope was exposed, the wind slicing across it at high speed, the snow deep and uneven. Temperatures had fallen well below minus 30. Frostbite would begin in minutes for any exposed skin.
This is making me want to go and put my coat on, seriously.
It's making my feet feel numb.
Oh God, I'm so cold now.
Every step required effort. Every breath stung the lungs. And yet they walked. Footstep after footstep, they moved away from the warmth, from shelter, from everything that could have kept them alive. Even the position of the tent raised questions. It was still upright in its framework, suggesting the collapse had been gradual. If an avalanche had occurred, or if a storm had torn through the area violently, the tent would have been flattened, buried, or blown away. Instead, it remained intact, a silent witness to the choices that it made that night. Investigators noted that the slashes in the canvas were not uniform. Some were jagged, hurried, almost frantic. Others were longer, smoother, as if made by someone cutting with calm precision. It was as if the act of escape had started in panic and ended with methodical determination. The tent, in a way, tells a timeline. First fear, then decision, then flight. And yet the reason for that flight remains unknown. What could have frightened 9 experienced hikers enough to abandon shelter in the middle of a blizzard? Was it snow shifting above them? A sudden noise? Or the feeling of pressure on the tent? Or something far less explainable, something invisible and psychological? A fear that no one outside could understand. Even today, the tent is perhaps the most haunting piece of evidence. It tells us that the hiker's flight was deliberate, that it was urgent, and that it was guided by an instinct stronger than logic, stronger than experience, even stronger than survival. And all the while, the tent remained. A quiet, empty shell cut from the inside, full of the belongings they never had a chance to use, standing as a silent witness to one of the most inexplicable decisions in modern history. What the search team found at the campsite was not just tragedy, it was a scene that seemed to defy reason. It unfolded in layers, each discovery more unsettling than the last, each one revealing a glimpse of what must have happened during that night of chaos and terror. The first 2 bodies were found beneath a massive cedar tree at the edge of the forest. Yuri Doroshenko and Yuri Krivonoshenko. Their discovery set the tone for everything that would follow. They were nearly naked. Shirts and underwear clung to frostbitten skin, torn in frantic attempts to escape the cold. Their bodies were darkened by frostbite, fingers swollen, blistered or burned, evidence of a desperate attempt to manipulate branches, start fires or generate warmth with hands already numb beyond comprehension. Nearby, the remains of a small fire, hastily built, weak and nearly extinguished, suggested that even in the darkness and biting cold, they had tried to survive. Above them, branches snapped high into the cedar tree told another story. Someone had climbed it. Perhaps to locate the tent, perhaps to see beyond the snowstorm, or perhaps to simply escape a fear they could not articulate. Their positioning indicated not panic in the conventional sense, but methodical, purposeful attempts at survival. Step by step, movement measured, yet ultimately futile. Further along the slope, between the cedar tree and the abandoned tent, searchers found 3 more bodies. Igor Dyatlov, the leader, Zinaida Kolmogorova, and Rustem Slobodin. These hikers had made their partway back toward the tent. They faced uphill, struggling against snow and wind, desperate to reach the shelter. Their bodies were positioned as if frozen mid-effort, hands outstretched, feet partially buried in the snow. These were not people who had succumbed suddenly. They had tried to return. They had fought against the mountain's grip, and yet, hypothermia and exhaustion had claimed them before they could reach safety. Hypothermia is insidious. It doesn't strike with sudden violence. It creeps in, clouding thought, dulling sensation, making even simple movements a monumental task. It warps judgment. It creates hallucinations, illusions of warmth and false confidence. And in the case of these hikers, it would have stripped away the careful planning and calm decisiveness that had characterized their journey until this night. And then there were the final 4. The most confounding and horrifying discovery. These bodies were hidden deep in a ravine, revealed only as spring melted enough snow to expose the frozen terrain. Lyudmila Dubanina, Semyon Zolotaryov, Nikolai Tibobrinyol, and Alexander Kolovatov. The injuries were grotesque, shocking, and unlike anything seen in the first 5. Multiple crushed ribs, shattered skulls, internal trauma so severe that it resembled the aftermath of a high-speed car crash. And yet, there were no external wounds. No bruises, no scratches. Lyudmila Dubanina's tongue was missing, a detail that added to the mounting enigma. Medical examiners would later describe the force required to inflict such injuries as immense, comparable to being compressed under hundreds of kilograms of weight, yet not leaving marks on the skin. The positioning of the bodies suggested movement, struggle, and attempts at survival. One may have tried to climb a slope, another tried to wedge themselves into a depression for shelter. Clothes were haphazardly layered, some soaked with melting snow or blood. Boots were missing or left behind. Hands and fingers bore the unmistakable signs of frantic, desperate efforts to grasp something. A branch, a rock, or even a fellow hiker. Anything that might prolong life. The footprints around the ravine added another chilling layer. Some were bare, some covered in socks, some mismatched. At first, the tracks suggested the group staying together, but as the distance increased, it became clear that the hikers had separated, some collapsing where they fell, others staggering forward in a tragic attempt to return to the tent or to find shelter. The snow preserved these steps as a frozen record of desperation, each one a silent testament to panic and determination. And yet, there was an eerie order amid the chaos. Even in death, even in hypothermia, even under the extreme stress of the environment, their movements were deliberate, not random, not chaotic. Step by step, they attempted to survive, and step by step, the mountain claimed them. The cedar, the slope, the ravine. Together, these sites tell a story of 9 people stripped of control, caught in a cascade of physical, environmental, and psychological forces beyond their ability to manage. Each body tells part of the story. Together, they reveal a night in which rational thought and human skill were not enough. It is in this combination that the Dyatlov Pass mystery is at its most human and its most terrifying. It is a story of effort, endurance, fear, and inevitability. A story in which the wilderness itself becomes an unyielding force, claiming those who underestimate it and leaving behind evidence that fascinates, confounds, and haunts.
So for me, the big question here is, why were they all together and then they separated? What was it that made them separate? Was it maybe just a disagreement on what they should do next?
Were they being chased?
Well, it's saying the movements were slow, but they're also saying chaotic, so...
That's what I'm saying, like, it's quite contradictive, whole thing, isn't it?
They've got time to actually try and survive, you know, to do things to try and survive. So that doesn't indicate...
Well, it doesn't indicate that they're under pressure to get away from something, does it?
But it doesn't sort of dismiss the idea that there was something there that they didn't want to stay in contact with, or, you know, they wanted to distance themselves from. But obviously they need to survive while they're out there.
And I think, like it just explained, the first 4 bodies that were found, it's kind of, you would expect to find them in the way that they were found. I know some of them had shoes missing and stuff, but it sounds just like their body was frozen, they'd suffer from hypothermia. Some of them had tried to get back to the tent, but then why are they trying to get back to the tent when they've just cut a hole out of it to get out?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well. Unless the danger that was present there has since gone or have moved somewhere else.
And maybe they could see that from where they were by the tree line.
Maybe that was kind of like a lookout, you know, someone getting up the trees to see.
But it was the other 5 that I find more intriguing, and the injuries that they sustained as opposed to the other 4. Because I think the 5 with the internal injuries, it's almost inexplicable compared to what the other people went through. How do you have a tongue missing? How do you have internal injuries consistent with a car crash, but you have nothing external?
It suggests a great force, doesn't it?
That doesn't really make any sense, does it?
But with a car crash, you know, they're talking about car crash type injuries, which means, you know, something running into something, that kind of thing, which would cause great internal injury.
It would also cause great external, yeah.
But in this case, it's not. It's almost like some kind of outside pressure that's done something to them. But then why not the others as well? Why just those, that particular group of people?
Yeah, that's what I find bizarre about this. And I genuinely, for once, I can't even think about what could potentially happen in that scenario. Like, what's happened to them 5 that hasn't happened to the other 4? And vice versa. Why them 5? And why not the other 4? Is it something to do with when they ran or walked away from the tent and then they split off? Did those 5 stay together and the other 4 have kind of gone in another direction?
Well, that's what's happened, isn't it? They've all gone different places, but why did they go different places? And whatever this was that caused these injuries, did it kind of zone in on those? Maybe something was following them. I really don't understand. I mean, there's different theories as to what it could be, which might sort of explain it, but...
Well, speaking of theories, let's move on to some theories and see where we end up. As if the injuries weren't disturbing enough, investigators uncovered another anomaly. Some items of clothing tested positive for radiation. Not all of them, but just enough to raise questions that were never fully answered. The Soviet investigation concluded in May 1959. No criminal charges were filed. Witnesses were discouraged from speculation. Files were sealed. The final cause of death was listed as a compelling natural force. No explanation, no clarification, just silence.
I don't know any compelling natural force that would take somebody's tongue out. Apparently it was surgically removed. It wasn't just torn out or, you know, which if there was some kind of natural disaster that did anything remotely like that, it wouldn't have been surgically removed.
Well, it doesn't even say natural disaster. It says natural force.
Compelling force.
Now, what the hell does that mean?
Well, I think...
Because again, I'm just going to bring it back to what could be so compelling that it could do such damage to the inside of your body whilst leaving no signs of injury on the outside of your body?
Well, you're talking about Russia, aren't you? Russia in the 1950s with a secret test going on. The mentioning sort of like radiation and obviously nuclear type of situations and things. So was it something like that? Was it... And this is why they've tried to keep it quiet, so that, you know, there was like secret testing going on. It's a vast area, isn't it? Did they not know that they were there? Or even worse, did they know they were there and it was some kind of test that they did knowing there was like human life there to see what effect it had on them? I mean, things like this have happened before, so you can't rule it out.
When the Dyatlov Pass investigation ended in 1959, it did not give the world answers. It gave it permission to speculate. In the absence of a clear explanation, theories rushed to fill in the void. Some grounded in science, some shaped by secrecy, and others drifting towards the edge of belief. Over the decades, dozens of explanations have been proposed, debated, dismantled, and resurrected again. What makes this case so enduring is not that there are no theories, it's that every theory explains part of the evidence and fails somewhere else. Let's walk through the most significant theories.
I would agree with that, actually, because I've read quite a few theories and they fit part of the story, but not the whole story. It's like as if you should combine three different theories to make it fit.
The avalanche theory. This is the most widely accepted explanation today, and the one endorsed by modern investigators. The theory suggests that a small slab avalanche occurred above the tent, sending compacted snow crashing down with enough force to injure some of the hikers and make the tent unsafe. Fearing a larger avalanche, the group cut their way out and fled downhill to safer ground. It explains several things well: why they left the tent quickly, why they didn't take boots or clothing, why some injuries resemble compression trauma rather than blunt force blows, but the problems emerge when you look closer. The slope angle where the tent was found was relatively shallow, not typical avalanche terrain. There was no clear evidence of avalanche debris when rescuers arrived. The tent itself was damaged but not destroyed, and the footprints leading away remained visible weeks later, something unlikely if a major slide had occurred. The avalanche theory explains fear. It does not fully explain the injuries in the ravine, or the calm, orderly retreat into the forest.
I'm going to say no to that, because where they found the bodies, I think there would be evidence that they wouldn't have, if it was an avalanche, they would not have had time to try and build a fire or anything.
And that just doesn't ring true to me.
It probably would have covered the tent before they could even get out, so no, I don't think so. And when they found the tent, it was only partially collapsed. I've seen pictures of it. There was some snow on it, which would have accumulated since the... You know, I'm guessing what they do is they brush the snow off, don't they? You know, periodical intervals. And so it accumulated, but it wasn't an avalanche-type snow, as far from what I've read.
Yeah, I also think, like they've just said about the footprints and stuff, that wouldn't still be visible if an avalanche had covered it.
It would have been covered over, wouldn't it?
The next theory is the katabatic wind theory. This theory focuses on wind rather than snow. Katabatic winds are powerful sudden gusts that flow downhill under specific conditions, capable of producing deafening noise, intense pressure changes, and even structural damage. Proponents suggest that such winds could have battered the tent, created terrifying acoustic effects, and convinced the hikers that staying put was impossible. This theory accounts for panic without requiring an avalanche. It explains why the group might abandon the tent temporarily, intending to return once conditions improved. But again, questions remain. Why not retreat only a short distance? Why split up? Why were some hikers so catastrophically injured? Wind can terrify, but it doesn't crush rib cages. I'm sure it also doesn't remove your tongue either.
Mm.
That to me just doesn't even make any sense. It can't be wind.
It could be, but... Well, again, okay. It's just part of the theory, but why, they were aware of risks like this, so why would they have camped on that slope?
Exactly, and also, why is he trying to climb a tree if it's that windy?
True.
You're not going to try and climb a tree if it's windy. Also,
I don't think you could build a fire in that kind of wind.
You couldn't.
Either.
You definitely couldn't. And I don't think wind is going to, like that said, crush your rib cage or remove your tongue. So I guess that's that. The next theory is infrasound and panic. Another scientific theory suggests infrasound, low-frequency sound waves generated by wind passing over the mountain in a specific way, may have triggered anxiety, disorientation, and panic. Infrasound has been linked to feelings of dread, nausea, paranoia, and an overwhelming urge to flee. Under this theory, the hikers may have experienced sudden, irrational terror, prompting them to abandon the tent without fully understanding why. This theory explains the psychological component, the flight without reason, but it fails to explain the physical trauma. Infrasound doesn't break bones. So again, it's like I just said, these theories are all viable to a certain degree, but it doesn't explain the full picture, does it?
I'm going for something military, really, because when you're saying about infrasound or whatever it is, I'm pretty sure they can do things like that. So maybe it was a combination of different things, because with it being Russia, I'm going for something military.
Well, really. Speaking of military, the next theory is military testing. This theory thrives in the context of the Soviet Union, a place and a time defined by secrecy. Some believe the hikers wandered into a military testing zone, possibly involving parachute mines or experimental weapons. Explosions in the air could explain pressure injuries without external wounds. Radiation on clothing could support exposure to military materials. There were reports from locals of glowing orbs in the sky around that time. The problem? There is no direct evidence tying military testing to hikers' exact location on that night, and no documentation has ever surfaced to confirm it, though skeptics argue that that's exactly what you'd expect in a classified operation.
That's what I was just going to say. So just because there's no record of military testing actually taking place there does not mean that it didn't take place there. So the record of it could have been erased, or, you know, it's under lock and key somewhere, isn't it? And just, you know, those that are higher up will know about it. But they're not going to make that, you know, public, are they, when they've just killed 9 people, maybe by accident, maybe not?
Well, we know throughout time that, even to this day, the military do things and no one ever finds out about it.
Until years later, sometimes. Until they do. And maybe not ever.
And I think this is probably the most viable theory, in my opinion.
This is the theory that fits the most.
It fits the most based on the injuries as well.
Because of the location, it would explain them leaving hurriedly because they were aware of something going on and didn't give them much time, and then the injuries afterwards. But also, what's not being mentioned is there was a camera in the tent that they found, and the photographs were all just sort of like, then you see the photographs of them. There's some of those photographs, you know, of just normal photos on it, but then some of them are of the sky, and there's a couple of frames on it where there's lights in the sky, and for some reason they've taken pictures of that. So maybe that was the start of it, and they saw something. Like, what those lights were, I don't know. Because then you go into all kinds of UFO theories as well, which is another theory.
Well, now, you know, now we don't know whether, if it was military related, whether it was done, whether they knew they were on the mountain or whether they didn't know they were on the mountain. But either way, I think something to do with the military is probably a more explainable situation.
That's what I'd go for, really, because it just ticks most of the boxes. And it's most likely, it's the most likeliest thing. It's a big, vast, open zone. If they're going to test something, they're going to, you know, and accidents happen, don't they? You know, things with passenger liners, and look at that one that just happened recently in New York. It's human error, isn't it, and things. Maybe there was they'd not seen a record of them going there. They didn't know anyone was going to be on the mountain, or maybe they just didn't care.
And the final theory is maybe it was a cascade of events. Increasingly, modern researchers lean toward a less dramatic but more unsettling explanation. Not one cause, but many. A sudden environmental trigger. Fear, disorientation, separation, exposure, and finally, accidents amplified by terrain and exhaustion. Under this view, the hikers weren't fleeing something specific. They were fleeing uncertainty, and in that environment, uncertainty is lethal. The injuries in the ravine may have come from a fall into compacted snow. The missing tongue likely resulted from natural decomposition. Radiation may have come from prior exposure through work or equipment. Nothing supernatural, nothing cinematic, just a series of irreversible decisions made under unbearable conditions. I don't believe that.
I don't think so, because I think...
I think there's too many things going on.
If that was all to apply, it may affect some of them in different ways, but it wouldn't affect all of them. There would be one of those people would have said, no, this is not right. This is, do you know what I mean? Like, it might have affected a couple of them to varying degrees, but it wouldn't have affected them all the same way for them, for all those events to have happened. And that bit about the chunk, I read that it was surgically removed. I don't know how correct that is, but that just seems weird on its own. Even the fact that if it was deterioration, I mean, wouldn't that have happened to all of them?
We've done millions of cases. Okay, not millions, but we watch true crime all the time. We listen to true crime. I've never heard of someone's tongue decomposing in their body.
Well, it probably does.
Like, to the point where it's not there anymore.
Well, the thing is,
it is a muscle, isn't it?
Everything's going to deteriorate, isn't it? So, but why does it not happen to all of them then? And there's an interesting theory about that, actually, that says that girl was the most outspoken out of all of them, and that if she thought you were an idiot, she'd just tell you, you know. And
that could be related to the tongue.
She was, you know, she didn't care about standing up and saying what she thought about everything. Did that include the government? I don't know.
But that is interesting.
It does make you think, though, doesn't it, that it was only her that it happened to. And if you're thinking it's a military thing, I don't know. They'd need to be on the scene. I mean, it's so long ago as well. There's varying... when they've asked people what they remembered about it, who would actually, you know, the rescuers and people who found the tent and things, one saying one thing, one saying another, so you can't really get an accurate and you know, there was no cameras or anything, like TV cameras or anything, the middle of nowhere, wasn't it? So who knows? But then there is another theory that it was like sort of a UFO related incident as well, which actually does tick some of the boxes as well, most of the boxes. It's whether you believe that.
I was going to say, I guess that just comes down to whether you believe in extraterrestrial life.
It also depends whether you believe that UFOs are actually not of this world, or if they're sort of man-made,
manufactured
by the military, or, you know, and they sort of, it kind of goes hand in hand, really. So, I mean, what did they see in the sky that they took photographs of? It seems to be a precursor to what happened next, so it obviously had something to do with it.
But even this explanation leaves us with one last uncomfortable truth. If this simply was a tragic chain of natural events, then it means something far more disturbing. It means 9 intelligent, experienced hikers did everything they believed was right and still died. No villain, no conspiracy, no single moment where everything could have been undone. Just a place where human judgment was pushed past its limits. And perhaps that's why the Dyatlov Pass incident continues to haunt us. Because it suggests that under the right conditions, logic can fracture, training can fail, and survival itself can become impossible to recognise. The Dyatlov Pass incident is more than a story of frozen mountains and lost hikers. It's a reminder of how fragile we are when faced with forces we cannot control. The cold, the wind, the isolation, and even our own fear. 9 young lives taken in a place that demanded respect and gave nothing in return. Their story lingers in the snow, in the silence of the Urals, and in the questions that will never fully be answered.
I suppose if that's true, then the moral of the story is don't mess with nature.
I think it also, and this is, like I just said, providing that you're willing to accept that it was just, you know, a multitude of natural events that happened. I guess it doesn't matter how experienced you are sometimes. Under the right conditions, everyone's training can fail. And everyone's experience can be overridden. Overridden, is that a word?
Yeah.
Can be overridden by fear.
Well, if that was the case, I don't think anything they did would have saved them, really, anyway. The setting of it was such that those powerful elements probably would have overcome them at some point, no matter what they did. But I just don't believe that.
I was going to say, I'm saying that, like, that's what I think. That is absolutely not what I think. If I had to put my money on it, I would go with something to do with the military, and it's been covered up. That's what I would say.
I'm 99% sure that it's something like that. In my mind, that's the logical explanation.
Just based on the injuries alone, I think if they were all just found like frozen and they had hypothermia, you know, like the two by the fire were found and stuff like that, if they were all found in those kind of circumstances, I would probably say, yeah, it's most likely just a tragic accident in nature. But just the tongue being out and their bodies being so internally damaged but nothing on the outside, I don't know, I can't get past that.
I think if you go back through history, there's always been things that the government have covered up. And unfortunately, civilians are not important. You know, they're just a byproduct of whatever it is they want to achieve. You know, so they're not valuable. Do you know what I mean? And then, of course, they're not going to admit to these things, are they? Because there would probably be an outcry, wouldn't there? So they're not going to do that. So I'm guessing this is not the first time that something like this has happened. But obviously, it
probably won't be the last either.
No, probably goes on all the time and we just don't hear about it.
And if you haven't had a look online, go and look further into this case, because it is really interesting, and you can have a look at a picture of, you know, the nine hikers, and you can see the tent, and you can kind of make your own judgment on what you think happened here.
You can talk about them, but when you see the pictures,
it makes it more real, doesn't it?
Yeah, and they're Russian, but they're just like any other young people, you know, going to university. And there's pictures of the bodies when they found them as well. So you see the pictures of the frozen bodies, and, you know, they do look strange. I mean, it's horrible.
I think we forget sometimes that when we're telling these stories, it's real people that it's happened to, and these were nine young people that lost their lives in a horrific, horrific way.
Yeah, they all seemed to go out, didn't they, with that mission in mind to accomplish, you know, this thing as part of the university course, and they were having fun doing it as well. And then you see the pictures of them dead at the end. So it's worth looking at, really.
And I just want to give a public apology for my pronunciation of those Russian names. I did absolutely try my best, but for any Russian listeners that we have, please do forgive me.
Don't write in. Right, everyone, that's it for this week on Murder, Mother and Me.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next time.
And remember, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime.